I'm Tom Getty, past chair of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group and from the Sacramento chapter. And we have a great panel for you today. I had a personal pick in getting my cousin, Cully Stimson, and my U.S. attorney, McGregor Scott, and LB, I'm sorry, I don't have a familial relationship for you, but we looked for diversity, and so I got a Navy JAG guy and an Army reserve officer, so I'm partial to the Navy, but... well, we won't hear about that. This afternoon, we're extraordinarily privileged to welcome, as our guest moderator, a distinguished judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, Judge Danielle Forrest. In August 2019, President Trump nominated Judge Forrest to fill the seat of Judge Dermot O'Scanlan, who had assumed senior status. She was then known as Judge Hunziker, where she was sitting as a circuit court for Washington County. That's in Oregon, not Washington. If you know Beaverton and Tiger, those areas. Judge Forrest was confirmed to the Ninth Circuit by the U.S. Senate in November of that year. Her distinguished career includes clerkships for Judge O'Scanlan, as well as serving as law clerk to Judge Paul Joseph Kelly Jr. of the Tenth Circuit and to Judge Michael Mossman of the U.S. District Court for the District of Oregon. She practiced privately for two top firms in Oregon, Stoll Reeves and Larkins Bacura Kayser, where she became a partner in 2014. She graduated summa cum laude from the University of Idaho College of Law, where she was lead article editors for the Idaho Law Review. She's been a friend of the Federalist Society for many years, supportive of the Society's commitment to open and honest debate of today's legal and public policy issues. Please welcome Judge Forrest.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here, and I thank the Federalist Society for the invitation to participate in the program today. It's been a while since I've been at a regional or national level FedSoc event. I'm active in my local chapter, and yes, I live in Portland, and Portland does have a chapter of the Federalist Society. We are small, but committed. So it's my pleasure to introduce the panel. I'm really excited to have this discussion today about sort of the costs and the benefits and what's at stake in this progressive prosecutor model that's being rolled out, and we have three distinguished speakers to address these issues. This is something, while I didn't practice criminal law as a lawyer, I certainly saw it as a state trial judge, and being in Portland, sort of have a front row seat to some of these policies. Oregon has kind of embraced a lot of these reforms and things that we're going to talk about, and so have a real world view as to how this is playing out and some of the costs and the benefits. So I'm really excited for our discussion today. I'm going to be very brief in introducing our speakers so that we can get to it. So immediately to my right is Cully Stimson. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and is recognized as an expert in national security and criminal policy and immigration issues. And as you've already heard, he's served in the military in the Navy JAG for a number of years, and he's been a prosecutor at the local, state, and federal levels, so has an extensive background in these issues. To his right is McGregor Scott, who also has an extensive prosecutorial background, having served as the U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of California, both in the George W. Bush and Donald Trump administrations, and then also serving as deputy DA and elected DA at the state level. And again, as you heard, time in the military, and currently a partner at King & Spalding. And then on the far right is Lauren Brooke Eisen, who has spent her career, as far as I can tell, thinking and writing about criminal justice reform issues, and particularly incarceration policy and choices. Before law school, she was a reporter and covered criminal justice and immigration issues. She's written extensively on these issues, including books and academic reports and articles. She currently serves as a senior director at the Brennan Center of Justice, leading their work on mass incarceration and working to change that. And so with that, we're going to go in the order that I just introduced them, and each of the panel members will give an opening statement, and we'll go from there.
Well, thank you very much, Your Honor, and thank you to the Federalist Society. It's great to see so many friends here. And it's an honor to be on the stage with all three of you, especially LB, who I've been in the reversed role where I've been in a panel where it feels like it's two against one, and I can assure my colleague that we'll have a collegial but feisty chat. Let me start with the headline. There is nothing progressive about the progressive prosecutor movement at all. It's dangerous, and in fact, I've been writing about it for about 2.5 years. We call it rogue, the rogue prosecutor movement. And I'll try to back that up by some of my comments. But I think it's important to back up and look at some crime trends in our country to understand how we got to where we got. Violent crime in this country was out of control in the 60s and 70s. It peaked around 1992. But in that period between the 60s and 70s and early 80s, the states started responding and the states started enacting laws to punish violent criminals. They started building more prisons. And because incarceration lags behind crime rates, the incarceration numbers went up. And they went way up. And so I think, honestly, you could say that there was, at the peak, a mass incarceration problem. We don't have a mass incarceration problem today. In fact, we probably have an under-incarceration problem because most people get away with crimes. 50% of murderers aren't caught, and over 90% of robbers, rapists, and burglars aren't caught, much less sent to prison. I pulled a chart that is in Pew Research that shows, in my upcoming book on rogue prosecutors coming out in March, that crime and property crime went down for about 30 years. And we've been benefiting from that decline for most of that time. And it's down because actual progressive, that means creative, prosecutors, people with new ideas, pushed hard in the late 80s and early 90s to create alternatives, alternative specialty courts like domestic violence courts, drug courts, veterans courts, family justice centers, thousands of alternatives to incarceration, because the criminal justice system, and I think, LB, we can agree on this as a starter, because we actually agree on a lot of things. We're not going to prosecute our way out of the problem. We're not going to incarcerate our way out of the problem. The criminal justice system is the end of the road. It doesn't fix all of society's ills. And so what many people who were creative, and that included prosecutors working with public defenders and judges and social workers and other stakeholders in the communities, realized is you needed to have a carrot and stick approach to hold people accountable, but not put them into prison if they can avoid it and you can avoid that. So that's how domestic violence courts and drug courts and all these alternative courts work. If you successfully graduate from drug court or domestic violence court, the chance of recidivism is really low. If you don't break that cycle, the chance of recidivism is really high. The other thing that contributed to declining crime rates was prison, prison sentences. Now, we may disagree on this, and I hope that LB takes me on this, or even Greg. Certainly the judge, you're invited to jump in anytime. It's your court. The U.S. Sentencing Commission's latest report on the length of incarceration and its relationship to recidivism says this. This is the seventh in a series. They studied 32,135 offenders who reentered the community. The odds of recidivism were 29% lower for offenders sentenced to more than 10 years compared to matched interest groups, and 18% lower recidivism rates for those sentenced to more than 5 years compared to matched offenders. So prison sentences, the longer they are, the lower the recidivism rates are. There are 2,300 elected DA offices around the country. Incumbents win 95% of their races. In fact, when they are in contested races, they tend not to run. These are low dollar, low visibility races. I know Greg was a DA in a county here in California. He might be able to speak more about that. But what the Soros rogue prosecutor movement realized early on is the DA, that guy, is the gatekeeper to the criminal justice system. It's not the mayor, it's not the city council, it's not the governor, it's not the sheriff, it's not the police chief, it's the DA. If she says we're not prosecuting, that's it. Game over. The rogue prosecutor movement operates under two fundamental beliefs. One is that the entire criminal justice system is systemically racist. These are their words, not mine. And two, that you have to fundamentally reverse engineer and dismantle the system as you know it to exact change. Those are Rachel Barkow's words, not mine. The ABA, our favorite institution, says that the role of the prosecutor is, quote, "The prosecutor should seek to protect the innocent and convict the guilty, consider the interests of the victim and witnesses, and respect the constitutional and legal rights of all persons, including suspects and defendants," unquote. That's not what this movement does. They don't do that. The roots of this movement, going way back in the chapter we have in our upcoming book, start with the prison abolitionist movement. Angela Davis wrote, "Our prison's obsolete." Patrice Cullors and other devotees of her have been pushing this concept of abolishing all prisons. I know it sounds nutty, but this is part of the roots of this movement. And they have four features, which I know Greg is going to go into. This movement wants to, and does, in fact, usurp the constitutional role of the legislature. Two, they abuse or misunderstand the role of the DA. Three, crime goes up exponentially. And they ignore victims and victims' rights, and they treat the police as the enemy. This is their MO. So it started in 2015 when Whitney Timas, a Soros employee, and Chloe Cockburn, an employee of the ACLU, decided to get money from Soros to unseat three pro-death penalty elected DAs in the South, in Louisiana and Mississippi. They got $1 million. They put it into a safety and justice pack, which you see those popping up all over the place now, and they won. They won those three races. And then they decided to go big. Instead of just going after DAs who supported the law, which was the law in those states, the death penalty was a penalty that was available on the books, they decided, you know what, we're going to seek to elect pro-criminal, anti-victim zealots under the guise of reimagining prosecution and reforming the criminal justice system. Now, the real reformers, the real progressives, are the ones I talked about before. The people who said the status quo is unacceptable. We're all for reform. Heritage is for the First Step Act. The criminal justice system is 18,000 police departments, and there's a state and federal level. So we're all for reform. But the question is, what kind of reform? Emily Bazelon, some of you may have read her work, summed up their playbook. Quote, "Change who occupies the prosecutor's office, and you can make the system operate differently," unquote. And so that's what they did. They went out and started recruiting, and Soros started setting up safety and justice packs all around the country, and they elected the first rogue prosecutor, Kim Fox, in 2015. She ran against Anita Dunn. I'm sorry, not Anita Dunn. Anita Alvarez in Cook County. She was the first female Latina elected DA, state's attorney, in Cook County. She's a Democrat, but because she didn't bend a knee to BLM and she didn't release the video of the police-involved shooting and killing of Laquan McDonald early enough, they primaried Anita Alvarez, and Kim Fox beat her with over $1 million of Soros money. And then Soros has poured millions of dollars, $40 million in direct spending and up to $1 billion in indirect spending for peoples like Kim Gardner in St. Louis, George Gascon here in L.A., Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, Alvin Bragg, Rachel Rollins in Boston, Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore, Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. You know, some of those people don't occupy those offices to this day. Let me just tick off some of their policies quickly and some of the crime rates that have gone up because of it, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues. First off, they have proudly waving their regal wand and declared entire categories of crimes they are not willing to prosecute. All right, so George Gascon, Rachel Rollins. Rachel Rollins had the Rollins 15, 15 crimes you can commit in Boston. Things like resisting arrest, trespass, disturbing the peace, driving without a license, all drug possession, any drug, all drug paraphernalia, possession with intent to distribute, breaking and entering a dwelling house if it's unoccupied or you're cold. You can imagine being the defense attorney in that one. Secondly, they don't prosecute and send juveniles to adult court. Carte blanche in most of these. They prohibit their deputy DAs from doing that. George Gascon here sent out in his directives a prohibition on sentencing enhancements and allegations. So if somebody's caught with a gun, and under the state law you can add a gun allegation to the charge, his DAs would not allow that extra charge, which exposed you to extra time, be added to the allegations. Allegations of priors, not allowed. Let me look at some of his other directives here. No three strikes, no one strikes. You can't ask for life without parole, even though now, some of these things are state law, and so the DA's Association here in L.A. has actually sued their boss, and that's winding its way through the courts. They've set up a habeas corpus litigation unit, not to do the things that are the bread and butter of a DA's office, but to unwind convictions. Of course, they don't allow anyone to ask for the death penalty in any cases. They have another unit here in the L.A. DA's office that is unwinding 30,000 convictions that, by the way, have survived appeal. Or anyone who has served 15 years or more of a sentence, their deputy DAs have to join with the public defender to move the court to let them out, even though they have decades more time to serve. And what has been the result been? A disaster. The irony of this movement, the very, very sad irony of this movement, is it's killing the very people they pretend to care the most about, black and brown minorities, by the tens of thousands. In the 5 years before Marilyn Mosby, the DA in Baltimore, called the state's attorney, in the 5 years before she was elected, there were 23,707 aggravated assaults. In the 5 years since she was elected, there were 26,519, or an extra 2,812 assaults. You say, okay, assaults, fine, that's not that much. What about armed robbery? In the 5-year running average before she was elected, compared to the 5-year running average after she was elected, in terms of armed robbery, 7,541 extra. In Chicago, where Kim Fox has been the DA, we can show you charts that we're going to be including in our book. Here are homicides in Chicago in blue in the years before Kim Fox was elected. And then you can see the red. By the way, this way preceded COVID. So don't buy this narrative that crime went up as a result of COVID. That's not true. Crime started going up in these cities with the toxic trio of rogue prosecutors, defund the police types, and demoralize the police around 2015, 2016. And you can see those homicides have gone through the roof. There were around 1,412 extra homicides in Chicago under the rolling average. Philadelphia averaged 271 homicides per year before Larry Krasner was elected. Now it averages 440 per year. But if you're a car owner or a store owner in Philadelphia, it's worse for you. In the 5 years before Krasner took office, there were 37,061 retail thefts, or an average of 7,412 per year. Now that is 9,084 per year. In other words, there have been 1,672 extra retail thefts. But carjackings, Philadelphia now is the carjacking mecca of the country, thanks to this soft-on-crime, hands-off approach. There were 14,872 extra carjackings in Philadelphia under Krasner's reign. And let me leave you with an apples-to-apples comparison. Because don't buy the narrative that crime is going up in every city. It's not. In cities with real prosecutors, traditional law and order, reform-minded prosecutors who understand their role to prosecute the guilty, San Diego and Philadelphia are the seventh largest cities in this country. They're tied. They both have crime, they both have gangs, they both have a lot of pressures because 5 runs up the middle of San Diego, 95 runs up the middle of Philadelphia. Last year, 551 murders in Philadelphia, 51 in San Diego. Crime has not gone up in San Diego. Thefts, robberies, residential burglaries, and all the rest of it have remained steady or actually gone down. That's the difference between a real prosecutor and a rogue prosecutor. This movement is failing, but it's not failing fast enough.
McGregor?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to touch on a couple of things that Cully discussed, but I also want to speak more from a philosophical or legal perspective in the broader role of the public prosecutor in our system. But before I do that, I want to call out just a couple of things real quick. I do want to note that our Sacramento chapter of the Federal Society is extremely well represented here today, so let me hear it if you're from Sacramento today. Secondly, based on our location, I wanted to pass along to you, I'm presently reading a terrific book called The Peacemaker about Ronald Reagan's national security and foreign policy. And for a kid who graduated high school in 1981 and came of age in that time, it's a wonderful read, and I encourage you to read that. The third thing I want to note is that Judge Forrest and I have a shared taste in young law students, as I've hired our summer law clerk from last year, and Judge Forrest has just offered her a job to come clerk for her. So appreciate that very much. You can guess which one she chose to take first. I think at root what we're talking about here today is what Edmund Burke called ordered liberty. And he defined that as the fact that individual freedom is limited by the need for order in society, a reconciliation of the conflicting demands of public order and personal freedom. In the United States, the rule of law is the cornerstone of that ordered liberty. But it only works when each of the branches of our government stay in their own respective lane. Public prosecutors have a central role in striking that balance. But in my humble opinion, they fail very fundamentally in two distinct ways in effectively carrying out their assigned role in achieving ordered liberty in our society. The first, simply put, is the separation of powers. The United States Constitution, as we all know, legislative, executive, judicial. The California Constitution goes even further. Article 3, Section 3 of the California State Constitution reads, "The powers of the state government are legislative, executive, and judicial. Persons charged with the exercise of one power may not exercise either of the others except as permitted by this Constitution." It could not be more clear. If you're a judge, you're a judge. If you're a legislator, you're a legislator. If you're a member of the executive branch, you are a member of the executive branch, and never shall the two or three cross. When progressive prosecutors unilaterally choose not to enforce whole categories of crimes or statutory sentencing enhancements, they usurp the proper role of the legislature. Now, I want to be clear, because some will say, oh, they're just exercising prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutorial discretion, as traditionally defined, is a case-by-case analysis by a prosecutor's office of the merits or lack thereof of a specific case. It is not the wholesale abandonment of the prosecution of entire categories of crimes that have been created by the state legislature and the governors over the years. Simply put, if you want to change the law, which by their own admission is part of the fundamental core mission of these progressive prosecutors, run for the state legislature, don't run for DA. The second foundational piece that these progressive prosecutors, or rogue prosecutors, as Cully likes to call them, have abandoned wholesale is the proper role of the district attorney in our system of criminal justice. Let me be clear. As then Attorney General Robert Jackson so famously said in his speech to the assembled United States attorneys in the early 1940s, the job of the public prosecutor is to see that justice is done, not that a prosecution be gained if the evidence and the law don't merit that conviction. Many times, the very best thing that a criminal defendant can have is a smart, ethical prosecutor on the other side who understands that ultimate obligation of the public prosecutor. However, ours is an adversarial system. It is that simple. That is why criminal cases in the state of California are captioned "The People of the State of California versus John Doe." Why cases in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania are captioned "The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania versus William Smith." This is an adversarial system. The following is a quote from the website of the California District Attorneys Association on the proper role of the district attorney. Quote, "The primary role of the district attorney is to protect the community he or she is elected to serve. District attorneys represent the public and endeavor to improve public safety by prosecuting those who threaten the well-being of the community and its citizens by breaking the law," end quote. It is not to serve as a second defense attorney, which is so much of what we have seen in these various jurisdictions across the country which have elected progressive prosecutors. A quote that I think captures the entire concept, Brooke Jenkins is now the elected district of San Francisco. She was once upon a time a senior prosecutor in that office, but resigned because of what she saw Chesa Bodine doing in that office. And at the time of her resignation, she said, quote, "His goal appears to be what is best for the individual who has been arrested for a crime or who has been charged with a crime, but not what is best for San Francisco." And I think that captures the whole spirit of it right there. The district attorney's job is to protect the community. It is not to serve as a second defense attorney, which is so much of what we see, as I said, in these jurisdictions across the country. This is a quote recently from a chief of police in Southern California. Quote, "What we are seeing from our officers on the street is that criminals don't feel like they have to face any consequences." And that captures the whole thing right there. Criminals not fearing consequences is a disaster for our society and the cities and the towns that we live in. As Cully talked with greater specificity than I will, the fact of the matter is that in these jurisdictions across the nation where progressive prosecutors have been in office, the homicide rates have been accelerating. And again, long before anybody had ever heard of COVID, in places like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, in 2020, Baltimore had its highest per capita homicide rate ever in the history of the city. The numbers in Philadelphia are simply astonishing when we look at the increase in homicides. And you know, we talk about stats, we talk about terms like homicide. These are dead people, 2,000 or whatever the number is, more dead people in Philadelphia than would otherwise have been the case if Mr. Krasner had not been elected. And again, to echo much of what Cully said, the fact of the matter is that when violent crime rates go up, it is persons of color who are disproportionately victimized by that rise in violent crime. So I personally find it ironic that those who suffer most from violent crime on a daily basis from this deviation from assigned roles in the rule of law are minority communities who, quote, progressive prosecutors, end quote, claim to care about most. Now, I have a lot of thoughts and observations about what's happened specifically here in California over the last several years, but I'll reserve that for questions, and I look forward to the opportunity to take those questions from you. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate the invitation to be here. I'm a former assistant district attorney, not an elected district attorney, but I actually worked for a Republican district attorney in Richmond County in New York, and he went on to be a congressman. And I now work at the Brennan Center for Justice, where I run our criminal justice team. We focus on reducing unnecessary incarceration, shrinking the size and scope of the criminal justice system. And first, I do want to get to some of the comments that my colleagues up here made, but I just want to lay out a little bit of a backdrop, just to sort of set the stage and pull back for a second on what we are facing right now when it comes to unnecessary incarceration and the havoc of what we have done to increase the number of people who are pulled into our justice system. So the Brennan Center, where I work, is committed to supporting policies that both reduce unnecessary incarceration and produce safe and healthy communities. That is something that I really do think all of us here on this stage and all of us in this room agree with. We are all trying to produce communities where our children feel safe to walk home from school, where none of us will be victims of crime. And we all agree that there should be accountability in our justice system. We have to focus on public safety along with improving the fairness, efficiency, and human dignity in our justice system. And they really go hand in hand. All of you here probably know that the US is the number one largest incarcerator on the entire planet. We have 1.2 million people who are in state or federal prison today as we have this conversation. There are more than 10 million admissions. Some of those are the same people in our county jails. Right now, there are about 800,000 people sitting in county jail. So that's almost 2 million people behind bars. 4 million people are on probation and parole. And that totals about 6 million people in this country who are under some sort of correctional supervision. For many of these people, the criminal justice system is not the appropriate place to deal with the drivers of why they may have committed harm. The Brennan Center released a report a few years ago where we actually found that about 40% of people in our state and federal prisons could be released safely. And that was based on two factors. One is their sentences are just too long. And there's been a significant amount of research that I know my colleagues have read as well about how prison is criminogenic. What that means is that when people go to prison, they oftentimes leave and may recidivate, right? We have about a 40 to 60% recidivism rate in this country. Prisons are not providing the rehabilitative services that so many people think that incarcerated people will receive inside. And we also know that crime and incarceration can both be reduced at the same time. In the decade spanning between 2007 and 2017, 34 states, that's more than half of our states, reduced crime and incarceration together. So we know that less incarceration can go hand in hand with safe and thriving communities. So let's just talk for a minute about what we know about prison and why prison doesn't produce safe communities. Each year, more than 500,000 people leave prison and return home to the communities they left. Most of these people are not getting the job training, the mental health support, the drug treatment behind bars that they need to successfully reintegrate into their communities. Many states simply don't have that programming. For example, in Florida, prison education programs are extraordinarily sparse. Many prisons don't have vocational training or reentry programs. When it comes to the federal system, there are about 150,000 people in federal prison. Only 8% of incarcerated people in federal prisons who are work eligible get to participate in the federal prison industries. State prisons fail to implement programs that are known to be successful, and work opportunities are very little. We also know that the fiscal costs of incarceration are significant. According to the Justice Department, mass incarceration in the US costs about $81 billion a year, and that's truly just scratching the surface. That figure only includes the cost of operating prisons, jails, parole, and probation, leaving out policing and courts. A year of incarceration in New York costs about, close to $25,000. The average cost of imprisonment in the federal system, according to the Bureau of Prisons, is almost $40,000. This is a lot of money that we're spending on a system that we know has a significantly high recidivism rate and is not producing healthy communities. This level of incarceration has massive societal consequences. It drives and reinforces deep-seated racial inequity and disproportionately punishes Black and Latino Americans. We know that 70 million people have criminal records that subject them to lifelong consequences. In fact, there are more than 40,000 rules and regulations that create barriers to reentry or just create barriers for anyone who has a misdemeanor conviction. As a nation, we truly do need to face how damaging incarceration is for our communities. The Brennan Center also recently released a report where we looked at the lost wages of people who have a criminal conviction or have spent time behind bars. We found that after release, people who've been to prison face around a 50% reduction in annual earnings. So mass incarceration has a depressive effect on our economy. And then I want to just touch a few points that my colleagues here made. So we were discussing prosecutorial discretion and the proper lane and the proper role of the different branches of government. And I want to just point out something that I think is really important as we discuss prosecutors and their role. And that is that when, and not every prosecutor is elected, but for a significant portion of this country, our local prosecutors are elected to office. When a prosecutor is elected, they need to exercise some sort of prosecutorial discretion. And I agree with you that prosecutorial discretion should be a case-by-case decision, but I think it's broader than that as well. I worked in one of these offices. There are a limited amount of resources. You know that. There are probably a lot of investigations you'd like to start in your own office, but you don't have the budget. And given that there are scarce resources for all of the prosecutors' offices across this country, prosecutors have to make decisions about how they will prioritize their staff time, what cases they will focus on, and what's not a good use of their resources. Cully, I think you mentioned clearance rates in terms of police. I know that this is a very significant issue in terms of public safety, that violent crime clearance rates are very, very low. It's something that all of us want the police to get better at. But that takes prosecutors' offices deciding what their staff, what their line prosecutors will spend their time doing. And if there's a violent crime problem in a jurisdiction, I don't want my DA focused on turnstile jumping. I want my DA focusing on violent crimes. And I think it's a better use of that office's resources to add more DAs to those cases and not to turnstile jumping. In terms of, you mentioned running for state legislature, our state legislatures have over-criminalized. We, as a nation, have hundreds of thousands of criminal laws and regulations. And given the nature of over-criminalization in this country, and I know the Heritage Foundation has worked with the Brennan Center in the past on this issue of over-criminalization, DAs need to make judgments about which of the hundreds of thousands of criminal laws are not going to take their office's scarce resources. And then I quickly just want to talk about some crime rates since you mentioned them. So we know some things about crime. We don't know everything about crime. The Brennan Center issued a report many years ago where we looked at why crime fell so significantly since 1991, which was the height of violent crime in the United States. Crime has fallen significantly since 1991. There have been a few years where we've seen some increases until quite recently. Violent crime was falling, and lots of smart criminologists, researchers, academics were trying to study and find out why crime rises and why crime is reduced. It's very complex. We know that COVID did have some impact on rises in crime. We know that people were isolated, mental health issues were exacerbated. We know that violent interruption services were interrupted because of the pandemic. We know that after school programs were canceled. But that doesn't explain all of the increases in violent crime. But there have been ebbs and flows of crime, and people have spent their lifetimes trying to figure out why crime rises and how to prevent crime. And I just want to flag a few statistics. Crime increases over the last couple of years happened everywhere, in blue jurisdictions and red jurisdictions. Some regions experienced it more than others, but every region in this country saw a double-digit jump in the number of murders relative to 2019. And the increase wasn't localized to counties, jurisdictions with progressive prosecutors. And recently, the Council on Criminal Justice just released a report a couple of days ago where they analyzed changes in murder rates from 2021 to 2022 in big cities. Chicago saw a 12% reduction in murder between 2021 and 2022, and Kim Fox, who you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, is the state's attorney there. New York City saw an 11% reduction in murders from 2021 to 2022. Philadelphia, where Larry Krasner is the elected DA, saw an 8% reduction in murders. Here in Los Angeles, there was a 5% reduction in murders. And so we can talk about changes in crime, and we can hone in on which jurisdictions, and did violent crime go up, did property crime go down, did murder go up, but shootings went down. And I think it's really important that we not focus, even though I did just read you some statistics, the statistics change. And we know that our justice system is not working the way it should. We knew that we could draw a straight line between mass incarceration and crime, we would be the safest country on the planet. We incarcerate more people than any country on the planet. So I look forward to engaging with all of you, but really did want to just take a step back and also look at the very significant fiscal costs and harms to our community that our increased incarceration rates have caused.
Before we open it up for questions, I just want to ask the panel members if you want to say any responsive remarks.
Well, I'd be happy to, and I really appreciate, LB, your comments. Here's a chart on the so-called 12% reduction in homicides in Chicago. That's the red. The reason it's 12% down from the previous year is because the previous year was through the roof. So that's honestly nothing to crow about. Here are the shootings in Philadelphia. The red is Krasner. Shootings have gone up substantially since he was the Soros-bought and paid-for rogue prosecutor. Here are the murders in Philadelphia. Yeah, murders went down in 2022 from a high of the previous year, and they're still above all the previous years. And so I take your point, but I think it's hard to hide dead bodies, and the numbers sort of speak for themselves. Michelle Alexander, in her famous and New York Times best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, talks extensively about mass incarceration. But did you know that her definition includes people who aren't incarcerated? I said that right. Mass incarceration includes people out on the street under her definition. It's under people under correctional control. So when you drill back and look at the numbers and you read Barry Latzer's book, The Myth of Overpunishment, you can see that when you have all of these crimes that go unsolved, and here is under the National Crime Victimization Survey from 2019, you can see the numbers of murders, rape, robberies, and aggravated assaults. This is a survey of 254,000 victims of crime. And then the number known to the police, the number that result in arrests, and then ultimately the number admitted to prison. 48.9% of murderers are admitted to prison. 4.9% of rapists are admitted to prison. 5.7% of robbers are admitted to prison. And 5.4% of aggravated assaulters. We don't have a mass incarceration problem. The reason we have so many people under correctional control and some in state and federal prison is because we got a crime problem. And they're where they need to be. Couple other points. I agree wholeheartedly with LB that we need to focus on human dignity. I do. And that's why as a criminal defense attorney, when I was a criminal defense attorney, I fought like hell for my clients. I know you guys have fought like hell for your clients, but victims matter too. Most people in prison are there for violent crime, almost 70% of them. Most of them have had between 12 and 16 prior arrests and convictions. These aren't people who deserve a second chance. They've had a lot of second chances. LB says prison doesn't produce safe communities. Yeah, it does. It takes that violent criminal away from that part of the community, and if you spend time in those communities, like I have when I was a homicide prosecutor, the people there will tell you, I don't want fewer police here, I want more police here, and everyone knows in the community who the bad dude is. They just do. I totally agree with LB on the need for vocational training, especially in state prisons, because that's where most of the criminals are spending their time. That's why Heritage got behind the First Step Act. That's why we were very encouraged by the previous administration's work on the risk assessment part of the First Step Act. This administration hasn't done enough on the needs assessment piece, and I think we can all agree on that, and more needs to be done. But that's a tiny sliver of the people in prison. Most people are in prison are at the state level. I remember when I worked for Secretary Rumsfeld back in the Bush years, and somebody stood up at a press conference, and he and I were doing a press conference. Well, he was doing the press conference, and I was his lackey standing next behind him. And they were asking about the costs of incarcerating terrorist detainees at Gitmo. And it was something like, Mr. Secretary, doesn't it cost $500,000 a year to incarcerate one terrorist detainee at Gitmo? And he said, after pausing, I'm told that the attacks of 9/11 cost the globe about $3 trillion. And so I think the cost of incarcerating the people that caused that is a minor pittance and worth it. And so when you look at the cost of society to the rapes and murders and thefts, stores closing, all these unsolved crimes, you have to take that into consideration when you look at the cost to society. It's probably a decent investment. I don't think many people, there's not a big societal push to let everyone out of prison. The last thing I'll say is I just respectfully disagree with my colleague LB, who I hold in the highest esteem, that crime hasn't gone up everywhere. She said that there's been a double-digit increase everywhere. That's just not true. That's why I use San Diego. Is San Diego some magic kingdom where the laws of physics don't, you know, cease to exist on this stove? I mean, did reality not happen in San Diego? When all these horrible police-involved murders happened, there weren't protests in San Diego. There weren't stores looted and stores broken into. Murders haven't spiked by double digits in San Diego, nor have robberies, rapes, and all the rest of it. Why? Because you have a group of people, from the public defender to the sheriff to the chief of police, and a real DA who enforces the law and holds people accountable. Holding people accountable does not mean throwing them in jail. In fact, throwing people in jail is usually the last step I think, in a humane criminal justice system. You ought to create alternatives to incarceration, encourage people to get on the straight and narrow, because we want people to aspire to be proper members of society. But having that jail sentence over their head while they're out in their program is the only way you can enforce that.
All right, just very quickly, as both of my colleagues noted, the violent crime rate in this country peaked in the early 90s. And there's been a lot of studies that have been done since then to try to understand why that happened, why it's gone down. What I can tell you, having been a deputy DA and then elected DA in that time, three strikes and serious sentencing reform across this country led directly to the drop in the crime rate. The studies all showed that 90% of the felonies were committed by 10% of the felon population. And when you took those people off the street, the crime rate fell. I don't know that it's a whole lot more complicated than that. The second thing I wanted to point out is that this sense of a cost of incarceration, and it's a legitimate policy point to make. I respect that. Mm-hmm. But what I would say, I think I got my numbers wrong, but if I understood Cully's stats on the rise in the murder rate in Philadelphia, there are 200 more people on average have been murdered in Philadelphia during Mr. Krasner's time as DA mm-hmm. that would have otherwise not been murdered. I suspect that if you went to the family members of any one of those 200 additional homicide victims and said to them, what would you pay to have your family member back? They'd tell you whatever it takes. So it's a legitimate argument to make. I respect it. But there's a countervailing argument that is not easily measured in dollars and cents, that people would otherwise be walking around on our streets today, would otherwise not have been raped, would otherwise not have been robbed, would otherwise not have been burglarized, if we had not lessened enforcement of the laws in this country.
So just very quickly, and I think we also all agree that criminal justice reform has been bipartisan for the last several decades. Again, we have worked across the aisle with so many different organizations. The First Step Act was a bipartisan bill that was signed under the last administration. Again, only affects those who are in federal prison. So, you know, about 150,000 people or so are in federal prison. But I just want to sort of remind everyone that there's so much common ground here about the inefficiency of the system. So when we talk about the fiscal costs, you know, if we have to spend more money on corrections and a smaller system that's really incarcerating the most serious violent crimes, maybe that makes more sense. Maybe that's a way to provide more programming and better training for correctional officers. So when we talk about the fiscal costs, it's because this system is so inefficient. The system is not providing the programming, the treatment that so many people need to successfully reintegrate into their communities. And then second, you know, you mentioned San Diego. On the other coast, there's Newark, New Jersey. And Newark is a huge city with 300,000 people. It really bucked the national trend of rising homicides in 2020. Murders were largely flat that year. They fell in 2022. In fact, homicides in Newark were down by 15%, 15% over the last year, and shootings were down by 35%. And I bring up Newark because Newark historically has had significant problems with violent crime. And I think it's really important for us to hold up success stories where crime has been reduced, where communities have worked together. And what happened in Newark is there was a high-profile consent decree with the police department, and the police began working with community violence interrupters, and a lot of community agencies and groups sort of joined together working with the police to reduce crime and reduce violent crime. And in fact, we're not going to get into it, or maybe we'll get into it. We haven't talked about bail reform yet. But the state implemented one of the most robust and significant bail reform laws in the country in 2017. And Newark, huge city with a lot of violent crime problems in the past, has seen a lot of increased safety over the last couple of years. So as we talk about how to reduce violence and how to reduce crime, which is something we all care about, it is important to hold up some of these cities that have been able to be successful at reducing these crimes. And you know, there are a lot of progressive leaders running Newark.
All right. We're going to open up to questions. I'm going to exercise the moderator's privilege and ask one really quick one, and then I'll just say, remember to ask a question and not give a speech. Okay, so my question is, I mean, in matters of public policy where we have competing values, history teaches us that the pendulum always swings. We ebb and flow, and we value this one, this value more significantly, and then we swing back this other way. So my question is I suppose more from Coley and McGregor, do you see this recent progressive prosecutor movement as just sort of the latest in the sort of push against law and order, or do you see this as something different?
Its origins, as I mentioned, is really deeper than that. I don't think it's a trend. I don't think it's a... there's a lot of money invested in this. And so what we are seeing is it's fraying. Chesa Boudin was recalled in San Francisco as the DA. This is not a Republican Federal Society stronghold in San Francisco.
There's a chapter.
All three of you guys, good job. Maybe he's up to five now. You know, 90%+ of people are registered Democrats there. Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore, part of the Baltimore political machine. Her husband's on the city council, Nick Mosby. She's as close to royalty as you can get in Baltimore. She lost her primary, and that's because of the numbers. And it was the chief of police and the residents of Baltimore who said enough is enough. Now, as LB wrote recently in one of her excellent pieces, Larry Krasner won his reelection, and Kim Fox has won their elections. And so I don't know if it's a trend. But it is a well-funded movement. And there, by the way, there is no countervailing movement on the other side because the delivery of criminal justice services across DA is spread across 2,300 DA offices. Greg, I don't know if you have a different thought.
So my thought on that is this is a coming together of two things. Number one is, and I've said this many times to cops and my, I have to now say, former fellow prosecutors, we've been the victims of our own success. The crime rates fell dramatically over several years. And we became the victims of our own success. So instead of crime being a front page news article day after day after day like it was in the 70s and 80s, it fell out of the media. And people stopped paying attention to it. So it created a public political dynamic where we could play around at the edges. And then the second piece of it is the Soros funding. We cannot overstate the significance of the Soros funding in this dynamic. The DA's office, historically, an election doesn't cost a lot of money. And all of a sudden, somebody walks in with $1 million in a DA's race. Guess what? That guy's going to win. That's how it works. And that's exactly what happened here in Los Angeles. Jackie Lacey, African-American woman, Democrat, career prosecutor, stalwart elected district attorney, got beat because every time you turned on the TV in LA during that election, George Gascon was on there. And that's because of Soros' money. So the political and public policy success of the tough on crime approach in the 90s and the aughts combined with Soros' funding has created this dynamic. I don't think it lasts, but so I will just make this observation. In February of 2020, literally right before COVID, I was on a panel on this exact topic at Hastings College of Law, my alma mater. I literally was going into the belly of the beast that day, let me tell you. I was the U.S. attorney. The marshal in San Francisco insisted that I take a deputy marshal with me because he was concerned about my safety. On my panel were Chesa Boudin, Marilyn Mosby, and Rachel Rollins. I note Chesa Boudin has been recalled, Marilyn Mosby lost her reelection, and Rachel Rollins required the vote of the Vice President of the United States to break a 50-50 tie so she could get confirmed. Great Katz, Judge Katz has left, but that's never happened before, folks, in the history of the nation. And she's under an ethics violation for violating the Hatch Act. And George Gascon, that is still up in the air whether that recall is going to go forward because the County Department of Elections screwed up how they looked at the signatures on the recall petitions. And there is no question, according to the polling data, he will lose if that goes to a recall. So I think it's really, at least in California, pretty dramatically swinging back in the other direction.
Just one thing. I mean, you mentioned sort of this funding as a problem. You know, there's so many people who don't have the ability to run, and you know, this funding can actually help persuade people who have really important policies that they want to implement to take office. And we haven't talked about transparency yet, and almost all of these, you know, reform-minded district attorneys that have won office have been very clear about what policies they're going to prioritize when they take office. Mm-hmm. And that's very important for democratic accountability. It's very important for the people in those communities to know and have a say in what priorities your district attorney's office is going to spend their time thinking about and driving towards. And that's really important. And you know, voters are voting in these prosecutors, and part of that is because they actually understand sort of what's behind the black box of a prosecutor's office for the first time in decades. You know, additionally, a lot of these prosecutors have improved data transparency with their communities. I mean, Kim Fox revolutionized how prosecutors' offices deliver data about the decision making behind the cases and behind why certain decisions were made with felony cases, felony convictions. The Manhattan DA's office also has a very robust data dashboard. And this is very important for democratic accountability and just something that I really think needs to be a part of this conversation.
All right, there were a ton of hands that went up. Right here in the center. Go ahead, sir. I guess, where's the microphone, though?
Serge Shubin from Los Angeles. Deputy DAs in Los Angeles County, probably across California, take an oath to uphold and defend the state constitution that includes separation of powers, that includes the punishment provisions like the death penalty that are actually in the constitution. At the same time, they are members of the executive branch and are expected to follow the directives of the elected DA. So how can a deputy DA reconcile those two very competing issues, both personally and as a representative of their office of law enforcement?
That is a great question. And it's interesting to me, when George Gascon was in San Francisco, he enacted many of these same policies. Anybody been to San Francisco lately? Yikes, right? And the DA's Association did not take him on in any way, shape, or form. Anybody want to guess why? They have no civil service protection. Not one ounce of civil service protection. So if they did anything against what he was doing, they'd get fired. LA, they have civil service protection, and they have pushed back. They brought lawsuits. They are contesting many of the things that Gascon has done in that county. So it's an argument in my mind. You know, when I was the elected DA, I thought having no civil service protection would have been the greatest thing ever for my deputy DAs. I've rethought that a little bit. And maybe that is a requirement now, because the DA's Association Los Angeles, for those of you who aren't from this immediate area, they have been very aggressive in pushing back lawsuits, public statements, criticizing at every turn Gascon's policies. And so it's a difficult thing. You do have to follow the orders of the boss at the end of the day. And I think what we have seen is really a mass migration from many of the DA's offices where counties have elected these people. For example, I am told that in Alameda County, which just elected a progressive prosecutor, people are leaving left and right. And that same thing has happened in other counties. I know it happened in San Francisco when Chazza was elected. So you're gonna see a lot of that. I think it will be the practical outcome of that inherent conflict between those two things.
If I could add, so I've become good friends with prosecutors around the country, not only because I can't keep a job and I keep hopping from DA's office to DA's office, but mainly because during the writing of this book, which took over a year, I've either reached out to folks or they reached out to me. And I've become good friends with John Hatami, who's a deputy DA here in LA County, and Eric Sedell, who's one of the head honchos in the LA DA's Association. And they do enjoy civil service protection. But when Larry Krasner became the DA in Philadelphia, he immediately fired 31 DAs first day in office. Gascon, who came from San Francisco down to LA, thought he could fire people day one, and he realized he couldn't because they were civil service protected. DAs in those offices, Mosby's office, as we detail in a chapter in our book, Kim Fox, Kim Gardner, they've been fleeing. These traditional law and order prosecutors have been leaving in droves from these offices because they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They wanted to become a prosecutor so they could prosecute. And when they realized that their boss wasn't interested in that and they had a whole different agenda, they're leaving. And so, and recall that in the lawsuit that Greg talked about, there's actually been several lawsuits. One of the Superior Court judges actually upheld the DA's association, and there have been appeals in that litigation. Actually, Neil Katyal argued one of the appeals in the appellate courts. And so they're in a real pickle because certain of these enhancements and allegations that are embedded in California law are requirements. And yet the DA, the boss, is saying, you may not do that. And so they're between a rock and a hard place. And so in most of these other offices, especially offices east of the Mississippi, they're all at-will employees, so they can just fire them if they're not on board. So that's a real problem.
Just a quick comment that when you know a system's not working, when you know a system's not efficient, when you know that there are prosecutors who may not prioritize justice and fairness and may only look at how long a sentence is and may not agree with what the chief prosecutor's policies are on certain cases, you know, it's natural that they might want to leave the office. And these are not offices where you necessarily have career prosecutors. I worked in an office where there were prosecutors who stayed for life during different administrations, and prosecutors who left and sort of moved on because they didn't like the policies. And it wasn't about progressive DA or conservative DA. So I just think we shouldn't, you know, paint in such sort of black and white strokes here. You know, you're talking about a type of career where people may leave office and may go on to do other things. They may move on to the private sector. And also, you know, I agree with you. Some of the strategies of these chief prosecutors who were elected was to, you know, let go prosecutors who didn't agree with the policies that they were elected on. But again, that's about democratic accountability. If they are elected into office on a promise to deliver specific policies to the jurisdictions where they are now the chief prosecutor, it's hard to argue with their desire to, you know, if prosecutors in that office don't believe in those principles that the voters believe in, you know, it is hard to keep those prosecutors on your staff. So I think that's something to think about as well.
If I could just very, very quickly, I think that the problem with that is that Gascon attempted, Boudin did it in San Francisco, first day. Didn't even give people an opportunity to sort of get on board with the new policies and fired them the first day because they were viewed as career regular prosecutors who enacted and followed the law. So that's the problem I have with that,
argument.
And that's wrong.
And I don't agree that you should, you know, immediately say, I'm just bringing in my own people. But there's a happy medium somewhere there where if the prosecutors really don't believe in the values that the voters valued you into office to prioritize, you do have to ask questions about whether they belong in your office.
Do we have time for any more questions? One more. Yes, sir. Standing up.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'm Tom Cairns from Los Angeles, and one thing I haven't heard much about, although LB mentioned the subject of over-criminalization, is in terms of the causes of mass incarceration. And it seems to me nobody's talked about the elephant in the room, which is the drug laws. And not just laws against victimless nonviolent crimes, but what we should have learned from Al Capone and the Volstead Act, which is that prohibition causes violent crime. And my question to the panel is, isn't it the case that either reform or maybe outright repeal of the drug laws is an essential piece of the puzzle in reducing mass incarceration?
So, I love that question. I'm going to break that into parts. Number one, having been an elected DA, having been a United States attorney, there is massive overcriminalization on the federal side. We need to get back to the concept that law and order is a local issue, not a federal issue, with some exceptions. But we need to get back to that. On decriminalizing drugs or getting rid of all the drugs, just look at what's happened with the legalization of marijuana in California. It's the black market is still absolutely in place. The cartels are still running the show. There has been no drop off in that whatsoever because the tax rates on the quote legal marijuana are so exorbitant that it creates this entire black market. So even if you legalize it, I mean, I said this in debates at the time that this proposition was going to be on the ballot. What, you think the cartels are just going to pack up and go home? No, that is not going to happen. Tax the cartels, good luck to you, sir. Well, I don't think that's a solution, having seen, especially methamphetamine, having seen the destruction that methamphetamine wreaks across every segment of our society, we cannot, in good conscience, legalize that. Fentanyl is the thing right now. Our young people are dying left and right because of fentanyl. So we as a society have an obligation to make it illegal and enforce those laws. That's my opinion.
And I would just add to that, and I think hopefully this is something that there's consensus on. At the federal level, there is a bill called the Equal Act that would eliminate the crack cocaine, powder cocaine disparities, and we're running out of time on the panel, but there's a lot of research and evidence that black Americans have been incarcerated more than white Americans because of the disparities resulting in crack cocaine's sentences versus powder cocaine. So I think there are a number of things that we can do from a justice standpoint, from a justice perspective, to right some of the wrongs of this drug war. And the Equal Act will hopefully be reintroduced in this Congress. You might know better than me. I think there were 11 Republican co-sponsors on the Equal Act. And so hopefully that bill will receive bipartisan support again. So I think there's a lot that we can do to reduce the racial disparities that the drug war created.
All right, I have one final comment in reaction to your question from my time as a state trial judge. I have no statistics for you, but I can tell you that anecdotally in Oregon, we have decriminalized much drug activity. And anecdotally, from my experience and from talking to my former colleagues who are still wrestling with that, the same folks that used to get charged and convicted of drug crimes are now getting charged and convicted with property crimes. Mm-hmm. So you're just shifting. I mean, again, I don't have statistics, but there is a shift of we're still going to have criminal activity. So we have run out of time. I want to thank the panel members, and particularly I want to thank LB. I got involved with the Federalist Society as a student because it was the one place that you could come and have smart and engaged and interested and serious-minded people come and talk about hard things and have disagreements and do that in a civil way. And that's what this organization does the best. And so I'm really thankful that LB joined us today and put herself out there.